everybody, and welcome to the Image Doctors, part of the Iconians podcast series. This is episode number 65 for May 1st, 2008. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And once again, we bring you all the goodies from the world of photography, particularly the Nikon. And today we've got a bunch of shorter topics, kind of an amalgamation of things.
A potpourri.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
Sounds like a topic on Jeopardy.
Yeah, it does. What is a lens that you use with Nikon cameras? Okay. Anyway,
that was
my Jeopardy question. So what we're going to talk about today, we're going to start off with a discussion of fisheye lenses, what's out there, how do you use them, how do you post-process images to get the best quality, and that'll be a fun one.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, we're going to talk a little bit about the RGB histogram that you'll find on some the newer Nikon DSLRs. It's been around for a little while, but if you're not using it, we'll tell you about why you might want to consider doing that, at least in some situations.
Yep. Then we'll bring you a short segment talking about another accessory that can be quite useful at times, and that's the right angle viewfinder.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of different ways of different models and different reasons for using this.
Mm-hmm. And then we'll do a short segment on VR. And our thoughts on it, is it useful or not? Should you consider buying a lens that has this feature as opposed to perhaps a cheaper one? We've gotten a number of listener emails on the VR topic, so we thought we'd just hit that. And then we'll follow up with our prescription for the episode, and that will involve hand-holding technique.
Yep. Okay, well, let's start off then with fisheye lenses, and these are fun.
Yep.
It's not something that everybody has. It's not the first lens you go out to buy when you get a camera.
It's not something you use every day.
But they can be quite entertaining to use, and they definitely are distinctive. And if you're looking for something to use as a creative, a way to break yourself out of a creative rut, a fisheye lens is one way of doing that.
Yeah, that'll snap you right out of it.
Now, let's just first talk about there's two different kinds of fisheye lenses that you can get. What's called the circular fisheye and then the full frame fisheye or rectilinear fisheye.
Right. And the circular one is actually the original kind of fisheye. And I think they were initially developed for astronomical use as well as meteorological use. The way they worked is that, you know, they had a camera with the lens pointed straight up at the sky. And then with this circular fisheye, which if you look at the actual image, you'll see a circle within the frame. And they had at least about 180-degree view, so you could see from, you know, one horizon to the other. And so you could take images that encompass the entire night sky or daytime sky if you were doing things with weather. There were even some that would go beyond 180 degrees, and they got to 220.
And with the circular fisheyes, you're always going to see the circle projection is going to be black in the corners.
Right. So very distinctive, very noticeable. No question that you're looking at a fisheye image with one of those.
That's right. And the other option is the full frame fisheye, and these are a little newer.
Right.
I say a little newer. They've been around for a while.
Yeah.
And these will also typically give you a 180-degree angle of view, but they project that onto the full frame that you use.
Yeah, and that's 180 degrees across the diagonal of the image. So it's definitely more restricted than a circular one.
Now, with all of the fisheye lenses, no matter which kind you get, distortion is extreme.
Right, that's the whole point.
And you figure it has to be extreme because it's showing you 180-degree angle of view onto something the size of a postage stamp.
Right.
So they're always going to have that distinct curved look.
Right.
And the amount of curvature is going to kind of depend on whether you use a circular fisheye or a rectangular fisheye, full frame fisheye, and also where you put and the kind of image that you have. If you've got a lot of distinct sharp lines in your image, they're going to show some serious convergence.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what's out there in the market, and then we'll talk a little bit more about how you use them, what situations, how can you employ them for creative use.
Okay, so we can start with the Nikon ones then.
Sure. And let's see. Let's talk about the older variety of full frame fisheyes first. Nikon's been making 16 millimeter full frame fisheyes for quite some time. And so you'll find manual focus ones that are of the 2.8 aperture, you know, maximum aperture variety. Those are a little bit newer amongst the manual focus ones. If you go back a little bit further, you'll find 3.5 ones. They're all pretty good, frankly. I've actually got a few of these here with me today that we're playing with. And the manual focus 16 millimeter 2.8 AIS lens, very nice lens. And like all the manual focus lenses, very well built, very nice focusing action.
Just feels solid.
Oh yeah. It's like a rock. And you know, frankly, you don't really need autofocus too terribly much with a fisheye. It's got massive depth of field, and you can just kind of pre-focus the lens, especially if you're not shooting at maximum aperture, and you'll have no problems at all. So if your camera is something like a D3 that, you know, is full frame, and it also supports metering with the older manual focus lenses, and you've got one of these things, heck, just use it. It'll work great. If you're using a DX, I should also mention there's the autofocus version of the same lens, the 16 millimeter 2.8. Also a very nice lens. It works well in manual focus mode or autofocus. It's the same optically.
So and they're both. Yeah, they're all about the same size. These are very small. If you've ever seen one of those soda cans, that the half soda can, it's even, they're smaller in diameter than that.
Yeah.
But it's almost the size of a 50 millimeter lens.
Right.
It's just a little taller than that.
Yeah. So it slips in a bag very easily.
Very easily.
Yeah. And, you know, if you do have like a D3, the 16 millimeter autofocus lens will work in all modes with that camera. You know, so you can do program mode if you want, or shutter speed priority mode. But, you know, either the manual focus or the autofocus is a good choice. And then if you have a DX body, which is probably what most of you are using, Nikon makes a 10.5 millimeter fisheye. It's autofocus, as you would guess. And like you were just mentioning, it's about the same size, maybe slightly bigger, actually, than the
16 millimeters.
Yeah, it's teensy, so you can slip
taller.
It in a bag.
And it's a G lens, so it's not going to, it doesn't have an aperture ring.
Yeah,
but then given it doesn't matter, it's a DX lens.
So. Right, so everything that'll work with is going to have controls on the body for the aperture.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, when I shoot these, I'm not using them at f/2.8, even though they are f/2.8 lenses.
Now, one trick that you can do with the 10.5, if you have a D3 and you're feeling kind of radical, is trim off the little hood that goes around it, and then you'll actually be able to shoot in sort of like a circular fisheye look if you want. But I'm not going to recommend you do that unless that's something that you're...
If you enjoy taking hacksaws to
your
lenses,
you're never going to want to use it with a...
But for something that costs over $500, depending on where you buy it...
Yeah. I probably wouldn't be doing that.
I would do that myself.
Yep.
But they're all of those are the Nikon options, and they work just fine. They all give it 180-degree angle of view. They work really well.
Yep.
Now, there's some other options for fisheye lenses, especially with some of the third-party manufacturers. And one of the things we like about third-party lens manufacturers is that they're always going out and trying to find ways to compete with the camera manufacturer lenses. And so one of the ways they'll do that is by offering more exotic focal lengths and different kinds of stuff.
Just options that don't exist within the manufacturer's
lens. Right. I mean, one way to, if everybody has a 70 to 200, but maybe you make a slightly different focal length range, then that's a lens that nobody else has. And that's something that Sigma has been doing a little bit. They've got several fisheye options, actually. They have circular fisheyes that are optimized for, they have one that's a 4.5 millimeter.
Yeah.
So it's optimized for DX bodies. Mm-hmm. Gives you 180 degree circular view. And it's an f/2.8. And it's a autofocus lens. It even has their hypersonic motor, which is their equivalent of AFS. So it's kind of neat. They have They have another one designed for DX lenses, which is a 10 millimeter 2.8 fisheye. Mm-hmm. So again, a very wide angle of view designed for DX bodies. Mm-hmm. And then they offer, I believe, an 8 millimeter fisheye for full frame cameras. Mm-hmm. They have an 8 millimeter circular fisheye, which is an f/3.5, mm-hmm. and a 15 millimeter diagonal fisheye. Mm-hmm. So you got four choices right there from Sigma, and all of them are they're probably, I haven't tried any of these, so mm-hmm. I don't know. I can't, but they're in the EX series, and that tends to be, if you're buying a Sigma lens, their EX is their top end. They're good lenses. Yeah. So recommend, and they're probably, depending on where you find them, they may be a little bit less expensive than their Nikon equivalents. Mm-hmm. That's one option.
Yeah, and again, you know, if you're shooting with a D3 or a film body, you'll want to go for one of those full frame fisheyes.
That's right. And then if you go over to the Tokina line of lenses, they have an interesting beast. It's a 10 to 17 millimeter zoom fisheye, mm-hmm. and it's a DX only. Mm-hmm. So this won't work on a full frame camera.
At least it won't give you the image.
Well, you'll get vignetting.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll have a strange sort of shading, mm-hmm. but I mean, you could use it on a D3 in DX mode if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly an option, but certainly more intended for the owners of DX DSLRs, which mm-hmm. is probably the majority of us.
Right. And so you get a more pronounced fisheye look at the 10 millimeter end. And as you go out to 17 millimeters, it's more like what you see on a DX body if you use like the Nikon 16 millimeter fisheyes, which is that lines are still bent, but it's not quite as radical of look because you're just going after the central part of the image, where the bending is a little bit less severe.
Right. The angle of view is 180 degrees when you're out at the 10 millimeters. Mm-hmm. When you zoom to 17 millimeters, you get about 100 degree angle of mm-hmm. view. So that's another option.
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty much the state of what's out there
yeah.
right now.
There are a few other things. I think there's some Ukrainian made fisheyes, and you know, there are fisheye adapter things for lenses. Those are kind of notoriously bad for the most part, mm-hmm. but you know, they work in a pinch. But lots of options. And just as a reminder, it kind of reinforces something we were saying earlier, the third party manufacturers do a really nice job on the lenses, and they're absolutely viable choices. You know, sometimes it's, you know, you want a matter of wanting to save money, and that's a sound reason. Sometimes it's just getting something that doesn't exist in the Nikon line.
And right. There's like a zoom fisheye.
Yeah. Some cool stuff. Now, how do you use these things?
Very carefully.
Yeah.
the first thing that you have to keep in mind is what are good subjects for fisheyes? Mm-hmm. And certainly outdoors, you can use them outdoors. You think of it, but you have to be very, what I find is you have to be very careful, when you're outdoors using them, not because of distortion, but because they have such a wide angle of view that if you don't have anything in the foreground, your images just look boring.
Yeah.
Other than curved.
Yeah. And so, sometimes you do have something in the foreground, namely your feet.
Yeah. You have to be careful.
Or the tripod legs.
So sometimes you almost want to use a fisheye lens as like a macro lens. Mm-hmm. I think when we were on Mount Evans last summer, I was playing around with wildflowers and just getting right up next to them. Mm-hmm. But what was neat about that is I had the camera in a portrait or vertical orientation, and the bottom of the image was the ground, the side of the cliff that I was on, and the top of the image was the sky. Mm-hmm. And we were on the side of a mountain road. So you can really get a unique view. And it's the kind of image that if you were looking at it, because it's a subject that doesn't have a lot of lines that should be obviously straight angles, you don't really realize that it's a fisheye lens that you use to take the picture. Mm-hmm. It just looks interesting. Mm-hmm. I know you like to use them indoors.
Yeah, I've used a fisheye quite a few times shooting things like cathedrals or other interesting buildings over in Europe. And, you know, it all depends on the specific building or room that you're in. Sometimes the fisheye look is very noticeable, and sometimes it isn't really. And, of course, you know, one little trick that you can do with a full frame fisheye is that if you have, you know, some line in the image, that's a key thing. And it could be the horizon. It could be, you know, a whole variety of things. If you place that line in the center of the image, it won't bend. It'll be straight. And that's a way of, you know, reducing the look of the fisheye lens if you want to, for some reason.
So that's a good tip.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, they work great for interiors.
And most fisheyes will focus down pretty close.
Yeah, the 10.5 is ridiculously close. It'll get down to,
you know, under a foot usually.
Well, yeah, under a half a foot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can really get close. It looks strange to other people when they see you using mm-hmm. this and you're right up next to it. You think you're doing macro work or something and actually you're not.
But just looking at it, it looks like the closest distance on this is just under half a foot or about 14 centimeters. So darn close with the 10.5. 16 millimeter, not quite so close. It'll get down to, about, I guess, 9 inches or so, or about a quarter of a meter. So not quite as close, but pretty close.
Okay, so that's that. Another challenge when you're using a fisheye lens is getting your exposure right.
Mm-hmm.
Matrix metering can be sometimes easily fooled when you're using a fisheye, because you'll have so much sky or so much foreground, and you'll have a very wide range of exposure values across the frame. So sometimes you'll want to use, I found myself sometimes switching to using center weighted or even spot metering mm-hmm. with the fisheye lens, just to be sure that what I'm putting that my subject is being metered properly.
Right.
Because it pulls in a lot of different stuff. You'd be surprised.
Yeah. And you know, one thing I've noticed with a lot of people, and it's true with me, is when I first get a fisheye, I tend to use it a lot, and then it kind of goes in the bag and doesn't get used much for a while. And, you know, that's for a couple of reasons. One, you realize that not every subject is really well suited to them, and the images can look kind of gimmicky if you use it too often.
Right, you don't want a portfolio full of fisheye images.
Right. But on the other hand, it is a cool look, and it's a shame if you never use it. So if you do have one, just pull it out periodically, take it along with you, and then force yourself to do some things with it on a shoot, because it is a great little creative tool and definitely will liven up your shots.
Absolutely. Okay, now then the last little subtopic here is, what do you do when you get home and you want to post-process your mm-hmm. your images? For the most part, post-processing with a fisheye image is just like any other image. You would just do your standard adjustments. But there's some things in particular that you want to be particularly careful about, or at least pay attention to. And the first one is chromatic aberration.
Right.
Because with fisheye lenses being very wide, especially in the corners, depending on your image, you can get some significant color fringing if you're not careful.
Right.
Or even if you are careful, you can get it either
way. It'll look nasty.
It can look particularly nasty. And so if you're shooting digital, this is one of those times where if you've got a program that'll do chromatic aberration removal, whether it's Photoshop or shooting RAW is probably your best choice, because then you can use something like Capture NX to just automatically remove chromatic aberration, or use the whatever chromatic aberration tool you've got.
Yeah, just quick note on that. You know, things like DxO, like NX, will remove it automatically. Mm-hmm. It does a good job with the Adobe programs. They've got tools for removing it. You'll need to do that manually. Now, the easy thing about a fisheye is, since the focal length isn't changing, you can create one preset in those programs for chromatic aberration removal and just apply it to every fisheye image. So it's very easy to do, and it'll get good results.
But it's something you certainly want to look out for, and so mm-hmm. check your editing package and see if you haven't looked for the chromatic aberration removal tools before. You'll want to when you start playing with fisheye,
because it makes a significant
absolutely
improvement. Now, the other thing that you can do if you choose to is remove the fisheye effect, and there's some software out there that will do this, and you know, rather than having the bent lines, it'll straighten them,
it'll make it more rectilinear.
Yeah. Now, when you do that, you lose a significant amount of the area, so it's not going to be as wide in the angle as it was before. It's still pretty wide, but you will lose some. And of course, there's no way to accurately compose the shot in the viewfinder if you're going to defish the image later on. So just realize, compose it with, some extra slop around the edges.
Right. It does chop off a significant area of the frame.
Yeah. And no matter which tool you're using to defish the image, and we'll talk about a few of them in just a sec, realize that in the center part of the image, it's going to look pretty good. Fisheye lenses are pretty sharp in the center. But as you get to the edges, because of the pronounced things it's doing to warp the image, you're going to lose a lot of quality. Because what it has to do is kind of spread it out over a wider area and then crop it. And
it's kind of like taking a globe and smooshing it down to you know how you get distortions with a Mercator projection on a map?
Right.
I mean, Greenland isn't really as big as it looks like.
Right.
Well, the same thing happens when you take a fisheye image and you try to defish it. Mm-hmm. It stretches things around in funny ways, especially in the corners.
Right. And it'll do things to stuff in extra pixels to account for, the stuff it's doing. But that doesn't, the resolution stays the same. So you're going to see a pronounced drop off in sharpness toward the edges when you do that. And it's typically fine for a smaller sized image, if you're making a 4x6 or a 5x7. But when you get up to bigger ones, you'll definitely notice the drop off in sharpness. So, the way I would suggest looking at it is, don't consider getting a fisheye in lieu of a wide angle, super wide angle lens. You'll just be disappointed if you do that. Because defishing is an adequate substitute for a real wide angle lens because of the composition thing that we mentioned with the viewfinder being very inaccurate, as well as the loss in quality. But it is a nice, emergency kind of thing. If you're in a situation where you've got one of these little teensy fisheyes and you don't have something like a 10 to 20 zoom or 12 to 24 zoom with you, you can pull it off.
It gives you a different composition option. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we were mentioning to the size, they're so easy to slip in your bag. If you have this fisheye and that was the widest lens you had, and maybe for example, I could see having a fisheye to go along with something like the 24 to 70.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I can use the fisheye. And then if I really wanted to get a different look, I could defish the image.
Yeah.
But most of the time, I'd rather use the rectilinear wide-angle lens than try to defish a fisheye image.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, what tools can you use to do that?
Okay. Well, we've already mentioned a couple of them because they happen to be some of the same ones that will remove the chromatic aberration, too. Both NX and DxO have options in there to defish the images. I haven't checked DxO lately, see how it does with a D3 and a 16 millimeter, but I know that the current versions of NX will defish a D3 image made with that lens.
Right. And what you'll see is that it's under in the base adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those options that's grayed out under fisheye lens. It's grayed out if you don't have an image that was made with one, but if you load a fisheye image, I've only tried it with the 10.5 with my D2X, then you get that option. You can just check the box and it turns it on, and then it magically defishes your image.
A few times on prior podcasts, we've talked about a neat little plugin for Photoshop called PT Lens that works in the Windows environment. And in addition to having a database of distortion corrections that work very, very well, it's also got an option for defishing fisheyes.
Cool.
So it's very cheap and very effective.
Okay, so that's pretty much wraps up what we think is the longest of our short topics today.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move on and talk about the RGB histogram, which is a fairly new option to view the image histogram on the playback mode in your DSLR.
Mm-hmm.
So start with the regular. We've talked about the regular histogram before.
Right.
And why you use it.
Right. And that's just a composite view of the light, that's in the image, how it's spread around statistically from
It's a range of
light.
The tonal values. Mm-hmm. Starting on the left-hand side, you have zero, which is black.
Mm-hmm.
on the far right hand side, you have 255, which is pure white, and everything in between.
Right. And just showing you the relative distribution of those tones. So again, as a quick review, if you had a histogram that was kind of all scrunched to the left, that's an image that has a lot of dark tones in it. And if it's all the way over to the right, that's one with a lot of light colored tones in it. And if it's just kind of neutral, medium gray, then you'll see things kind of centered around the middle.
Right.
Doesn't mean there's one that's good or bad. It just, that's what's going on in the image.
No, and generally what we use the histogram for is to look for values that are piled up on the left or the right side.
Mm-hmm.
And that typically gives us the hint that we may be clipping shadows or blowing highlights.
Yeah. And just to reinforce that, what you're really looking for is a spike. On the right in particular, which means you're blowing out highlights and you've got portions of the image of just clipped to pure white, no detail, no information in them. You could also have clipping on the blacks where it's just black shadows, but that's usually not as big of a problem. It's really the highlights that you worry more about. Those look uglier in the photo, whereas clipped blacks are perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. Just the way
it depends on your subject and what mm-hmm. you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So in the past, the histogram was just a single display, and it was typically based off the green channel mm-hmm. from the camera. The camera's recording red, green, and blue data to make the image.
That's where the RGB histogram that we'll talk
right.
about comes.
And I think it was the D2X that first came out that had that.
I think it was the H.
D2H? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, the D2 series then.
Yeah.
And then subsequently, I believe this feature has been in most of the later higher-end DSLRs. I'm not sure if it's in the D80s and those cameras or not, but it's certainly in the D200, mm-hmm. the D300, the D3,
right.
and the D2 series. And what it gives you is another option in the playback menu. You can have the standard histogram view or the RGB view, and then what it does is it gives you a thumbnail of the image, and then it shows three histograms. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think it shows you four. Shows you the overall histogram and then the red channel, the blue channel, and the green channel.
Mm-hmm.
I should have said that in order, the red channel, the green channel.
That's all right.
Channel.
I think they figured that out.
And why is that useful? Well, sometimes it's possible, especially with red,
yeah.
to have blown a value in a color but not overall in the image. And with red flowers, I'll use that as an example. It's possible to have completely saturated and blown out reds, and yet the image histogram is for the most part fine if you were right. to just look at the standard histogram, which is based off the green channel.
Yeah, and another good example of an image or a subject matter that'll cause you problems if you're just looking at the composite histogram would be, you know, some of the red canyons and rock formations and things like that we have here in Colorado and other places in the western U.S. Those are just notorious, especially under bright, you know, maybe early sunlight, you know, sunrise kind of conditions.
Warm lighting conditions.
Yeah, for being blown out in the red channel, even though the composite one is just fine. So that's definitely a situation where I'll use the RGB histogram.
And if you see that, then you can know to dial in maybe a third of a stop of underexposure.
Or maybe even more.
And yeah. correct that and bring that back. And what that's going to do is just going to pull those values back so that when you go into to post-process your image, you won't have a color that's completely strange looking.
Right.
And that helps. So
just remember, especially with subjects that include a lot of reds, that you absolutely want to use that feature. And usually when you first set up your camera, you'll have to enable it. So that's one of the options where when you click through the different things in
that's
your
right.
LCD display that you see it.
Otherwise, it's not usually in the default list.
Right.
And you'll sit there cycling through going, where is it?
Yeah, but just remember red demon images, you know, satanic images. Those are the ones that'll drive you nuts. And using that, you'll get much better results.
Okay. Hopefully that's helpful. Now we want to move on and talk about another fun accessory,
mm-hmm.
and that's right angle finders.
Mm-hmm. And in the past, we've talked about the benefits of getting down low to the ground for certain subjects. And it could be for wildlife. It could be a landscape where you've got a, you know, maybe a nice prominent rock in the foreground. It could be shooting pictures of little kids.
Or more, even more commonly getting things really low ground level, like macro shots, mm-hmm. where your subject literally is on the ground.
Right.
And you don't want to shoot down on the subject. You want to put the camera at the subject's level. It makes for a much more pleasing image, but it can be a real challenge because you find yourself lying down on your belly to take the picture. It's not always the easiest way to do it, especially outside. You could be lying in an ant pile or something.
Right. Yeah.
You don't necessarily want to do that. So
that's never good.
So fortunately, Nikon makes some accessories called right angle finders that you can screw into the or slip over the eyepiece of your camera, whether it's a film camera or a digital camera. And it's just an extension of the eyepiece, and it has a 90-degree joint in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you to be looking down at the top of your camera through the eyepiece and see what's in the viewfinder.
Yeah, and one reason that looking down like that is preferable is if, well, you might think, well, I could kind of lay on the ground on my side and look through the viewfinder the other way. And the problem is, first of all, it's never that comfortable. And second of all, it's very, very easy to get tilted horizons. Anytime I try to do that, I end up with a tilted horizon. It's just very difficult to get them level. You just can't quite see it. So these things really do help. And there are several of them that they make. The most recent ones on the market are the DR5 and the DR6. And they're really the same exact right angle viewfinder. The difference is the little adapter at the end that'll join it up with a certain camera series. And if you look at the back of a D2 or D3 or D1 series camera, as well as the older F series, they have circular eyepiece rings.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the other cameras, like a D300, a D200, D80, whatever, have a rectangular one. And so the DR5 has the circular one. DR6 has the rectangular one. And there are even some little nuances on the size of the circular ones. But the key point is you can actually get either viewfinder and make it work with any of the other cameras via a little adapter. Just pick the one that lines up with what you're going to use the most often. So in my case, I've got one with, it's the DR5 that has the circular eyepiece because I use my D3 more than my D300. But via a cheap little plastic accessory, I can also put it on the D300. And the reverse would be true. Now, with the DR5 and 6, you know, one thing that's kind of nice is they also have a higher magnification mode. The normal one is 1x. And if you flip a little lever on the top over to 2x, you'll get double the magnification and a reduced angle of view. You'll just see the center of the viewfinder. And that's pretty handy for doing macro work where you're focusing manually, and it might be a little bit tough to see
right.
What's precise focus.
And then both of these viewfinders typically have a diopter adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
So you can just adjust the focus so that the view screen looks correct. You use the focus indicator, or you look at the numbers in the metering, the display mm-hmm. inside the screen, so you can focus it properly. Whether you're wearing glasses or not.
Yeah, and it's actually better to use little markings on the focusing screen because the shutter speed and aperture displays are usually at a different distance than the actual focusing mm-hmm. screen. It's off by a little bit.
They're kind of tucked down at the bottom mm-hmm. of the frame.
Yep. And if you flip to the higher magnification view, you'll need to refocus that diopter.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you'll get a very blurry image. But it's very, very easy to do. Now, if you want to save some money, the older Nikon viewfinders, right-angle viewfinders, will still work with the newer cameras. Like you can use a DR3 with a D3 just fine, as long as you have the adapter that's used for a larger size circular viewfinder, and a DR4 will, you know, work on some of the newer rectangular ones. They just don't have the higher magnification option, which is kind of handy, but you'll save lots of money. They go for about half or less of a new one. So it's not a bad way to go if you're trying to save some money.
Now, there's some other options out there, too. I know there's some third-party manufacturers of right-angle finders, and there's one in particular that's kind of the most unique of the bunch, and that's this thing called the ZigView, where it's a LCD this monitor. It's a small LCD screen that you screw into your viewfinder. And so then you can actually use, it gives you kind of like a live view mode at the same time of having an adjustable right angle finder. So that's interesting. I've never used it either. I've seen them at trade shows and stuff. It's an interesting concept. And another thing people talk about is, well, I could just use the live view mode. And for that, I would say sort of. I think the live view mode is a little bit easier to use when you're holding the camera over your head than when it's at ground level, because you just need to be able to position your head to see it. While you can see the LCD display from a fairly wide angle with the D300 and the D3, the LCDs are quite good. If you can't get down at the view to see it closely to make critical focus adjustments and things like that, it's less useful. I find it's more useful with live view for when you just need to grab a shot and you want to make sure it's composed relatively correctly for the situation. But those are some alternatives to getting a right angle finder.
But they're a neat little gizmo, and especially if you find one of the older ones on the used market, they're not that expensive.
That's true.
Yeah, those can be pretty cheap. Okay, anything else on that one you can think of?
No, I suppose we should move on to VR or not VR.
Yeah.
That will be our question.
Yeah.
We get a lot of comments about that. Oh, I'm using this VR lens. The questions come in a lot of flavors. We'll get questions ranging from, should I opt for the VR lens versus the non-VR lens if I have a choice?
Right. Good example would be, you know, do I get the Nikon 70-200 2.8 VR lens, or do I get a much less expensive Sigma 70-200 2.8?
Or even the Nikon 80-200 2.8, whichever. And then another group of questions comes from the using VR in practical usage, which is something along the lines of, hey, I'm using this VR lens, but why aren't my images sharp? And what should I be doing better? And a lot of times it's for wildlife pictures, but mostly action kinds of shots. And people are asking us what to do about what's the best way to use VR. So it's two parts. So let's start with the fundamental question of why you would want VR in your or not.
Yeah. And, you know, in terms of why would you want it? Well, it can enable you to handhold a lens at shutter speeds that are several stops slower than what you could get away with otherwise. And how much of a boost you get depends on the lens. It can be anywhere from a couple stops to four stops, you know, which can be significant, you know, in some situations. And does it work? Yeah, absolutely.
It really does.
It really does work. It's not a gimmick. It absolutely works. And so if you're not able to use a tripod, and there can be a lot of situations like that. I, you know, mentioned shooting in cathedrals earlier, and in a lot of places you're not allowed to have at least a conventional tripod in there. You can sometimes use one of the little tabletop things, but you can't use a conventional one, and having a lens that has that VR feature on it can enable you to get good sharp shots in conditions that you wouldn't have otherwise. And you know, if you're working on a monopod or a gimbaled mount, you know, with bigger lenses, then VR can also help you stabilize the image, even though you're not actually hand holding the thing. It's definitely a benefit, and the same kind of boost in number of shutter speeds that I mentioned earlier will hold true with a monopod.
VR really helps counteract camera shake.
Right.
So where you see it most effective is with longer focal lengths, where camera shake is going to be more pronounced. It helps a lot with, especially on your DX bodies, where you've even magnified the apparent focal length more. VR can really help you in those situations.
Yeah, because oftentimes you end up using really, really long equivalent focal lengths, you know, longer than you would, you know, with a 35mm body or, you know, full frame kind of thing.
Right. So all of a sudden your 200mm lens is kind of behaving like a 300mm lens, and you're going to get all the increased camera shake effects to go along with it. So VR can help. VR is not going to... Now, what VR won't do is freeze your subject. VR cannot increase your shutter speed. That only shutter speed can do that. So depending on the conditions that you're shooting in and the subjects that you're shooting in, that can factor into whether or not VR is important for you,
right?
If given the choice,
right? If you're photographing a twitchy little bird on a branch, yeah, you'll get, you know, sharp leaves and a sharp branch, but the bird may be moving so much that, you know, it really doesn't matter if you had VR on or not. You don't get a good photo. Similarly, if you're photographing sports and you've got athletes that are moving quickly, well, you know, VR isn't going to help you with that.
Right. Now, where it will help with an action shot is if you're trying to deliberately use slow shutter speeds to pan and get blurred images. Then it can help stabilize your panning, and that can be real nice.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, where VR really helps is it just allows you to use slightly slower shutter speeds than you would otherwise and still get a sharp image in handheld conditions and eliminate camera shake. Mm-hmm. The other thing that it does is it stabilizes, at least with the Nikon system, the VR is built into the lens. And there's some discussion about whether or not that's the best approach or not. There's a couple ways you can achieve image stabilization. And what Nikon has done and what Canon has done as well is to incorporate lens elements that actually move. And what that does is it stabilizes the image in the viewfinder itself.
Mm-hmm.
So your viewfinder won't be jittery.
And you'll also get an accurate composition.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the other method is to move the sensor. You won't see that, and it is quite possible for the sensor to move. It stabilizes the image. I'm not saying that the technology does not work, because it does work, but it's a little less accurate, potentially,
right,
than if you're using it through the lens.
Yeah, I'd say probably the best of all worlds would be to have both.
Right.
But, you know.
But hey,
yeah,
we'll take what we can get.
Yeah.
Now, what's the downsides of VR? Generally, the lenses cost a little bit more.
Yeah.
I say generally because there's some VR lenses that are fairly budget conscious. And so when you're on the used market, you can often have the choice of, do I want to use the VR version or not?
Mm-hmm.
And
here's a great example of it. You know, one that, you know, that I was looking at not too long ago. Both of us in the last 6 months or so have gotten 600 millimeter lenses, me first, and then you copied me.
I know.
But I didn't want to spend the money required to buy the new 600 millimeter VR. That was just more than I wanted to spend.
Actually, a new 600 like millimeter anything is, yeah, pretty expensive.
It's a bazillion dollars. So I ended up thinking through that and thinking through the idea that, well, you know, that D3 is going to have really good higher ISO performance. You know, maybe that will just get me by. And so I bought a cheaper original AFS series 600 millimeter lens, and it was about, you know, $4,000 less than the normal selling price of a 600 millimeter VR. So I was happy about that, to say the least. Now,
I'm sure your wife was too.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, she probably wasn't happy that you spent it on a 600 to begin with.
But
at least if you're going to do it, right?
It could have been worse. And it certainly would have been with the VR. Now, would I rather have the VR lens? Oh, yeah. Sure. There's no doubt about it, because there are situations I can think of where it'd be an advantage.
Well, and this is a unique situation too, mm-hmm. because what you have are two lenses that optically, though not identical, are very good.
Yeah.
You're not trading off. We're not looking at the difference between having a 2.8 lens or a slower aperture lens.
Mm-hmm.
They're both pretty much the same lens.
Mm-hmm.
And the only difference is whether it has VR in it or not.
Mm-hmm.
I say the only difference, but for the most part, that's only significant difference.
Yeah.
And so then it can be helpful. But what if you're looking at something on the lower end of the budget scale,
mm-hmm.
like a consumer zoom? I would say then for a lot of the lenses, things like the 18-200, the 70-300, the slower lenses, what VR allows you to do is handhold a lens. Well, it allows you to handhold a lens because you're using generally a much smaller lens. It's lighter, easier to, more compact, easier to handhold, and VR gives you that option. Plus it gives you the ability to handhold a lens that might otherwise require a faster glass.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about going into the cathedral where it's somewhat dark, do you want to be able to shoot at f2.8 or do you want to be able to shoot at f5.6?
Right.
Some, if you have VR and a fast lens, it gives you that option. You can stop down and still handhold versus you can be able to just use a lens at all. Because a lot of the consumer lenses are fairly slow. The Nikon ones top out at f5.6 mostly. Mm-hmm. So it gives you an opportunity to use lenses in places that you wouldn't otherwise. You say, hey, I can save some money if I get the VR version of this lens rather than the non-VR version. So it's something to consider. Now, would I go through and upgrade all my lenses just to get VR? Probably not.
Yeah.
It's nice to have when you can have it. But if there's an exceptionally good value, I would think it's less important on the 2.8 lenses. Mm-hmm. You know, a 70 to 200 VR is really good, but if you can get a 2.8, 70 to 200 non-VR, you can use it in and yeah, use it at higher ISOs.
It's just all a matter of how much do you want to spend and what kind of things you're shooting. There's no doubt that it's not an advantage to have it as an option. There will be situations most likely where you'll make use of it, just like there would be situations where having VR on my 600 millimeter would be nice, especially like with teleconverters and stuff on a gimbal mount.
Just remember that VR is not going to bail you out from subject motion. Mm-hmm. I understand that. It's not going to overcome the depth of field. There's, if you want an f2.8 lens, you can shoot at f2.8 and change depth of field, even though it's like shooting with a faster shutter speed. They say it's like shooting with a faster shutter speed or at a faster aperture. It's not.
Right.
It's not really using a faster aperture. It's just counteracting the camera shake. So you just have to keep that in perspective.
It's a good substitute for a tripod in certain circumstances.
Right. And it doesn't, it's not actually changing the way your images look.
Right.
So
right.
Given the lens.
Yeah.
So that's what we think on that. Anything else to mention that?
I think that's good.
Okay, so we'll wrap it up with, as long as we're talking about VR and hand-holding, then I thought a good prescription for today would be...
Oh, one thing that we should add.
Oh, yeah?
Read your instruction book for your VR lens if you get one. So that you understand when to use it in normal mode, which is for most subjects, when to use it in active mode, which would be like if you're on the deck of a bobbing boat in the ocean.
Or in a helicopter.
Yeah, and it affects, you know, panning and stuff like that too. So read that. Also, read whether or not the VR modes on your lens will work when the camera and lens is tripod mounted and fixed.
Right, and by some tripod will, mounted, we mean actually locked down on
locked
the tripod.
Down, right.
Versus loose on a ball head or something.
Yeah, that's fine with pretty much any VR lens, but locked down will drive some VR lenses nuts. They'll start chattering away and won't be able to you know, give you a sharp image.
And you'll actually get worse performance from your, you'll get worse image quality than you would with it off.
So. Where some do work. They're typically the very expensive, newer, super telephoto things.
Yep, that's a good point.
Yep. Okay.
All right, so let's talk about proper hand-holding technique. Because we see this a lot of times, and it goes along with why are my pictures blurry? What do I need to do? Or gee, do I need a tripod? Well, there's sometimes where a tripod is just not going to be, usable. Mm-hmm. There's places you go where you can't use a tripod. And so you want to always try to get the sharpest image possible. And so it starts by making sure you've got the right shutter speed and exposure, et cetera. But at some point you've got to hold your camera properly. And what I see that the difference when I look around, when I'm walking around the street and I see other photographers out there, doesn't matter what camera they're using, the difference between somebody who knows what they're doing and the difference between a rank amateur is how they hold their camera.
Right.
You can spot these guys or women very quickly. And the reason why I can always spot the rank amateur is because they're the ones that are holding two hands on the camera body. Shudder. And no hand on the lens. And that's something that you shouldn't do. You should always have your left hand, or at least this is the way I do it. I put my left hand under the lens. I cradle the lens.
It's better than putting it on top.
Or to the side.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I hold the lens. In fact, most of the weight I support with the lens in the palm of my left hand. And then I use my right hand is the one that's on the grip and on the shutter and the command dials, etc. especially true when you're using a zoom lens, like the kind, like the 70 to 300 or the 18 to 200, where the lens, when you zoom it out, it extends quite a ways.
Right.
There's lots of reasons why you want to do this. The most important reason is that it stabilizes the camera.
Right.
Because this long telephoto lens, if you try to hold just the camera body, you're going to have a lot more camera shake, VR or not, than you will if you just support the lens with your left hand.
Yeah. Now, related to that, too, is that you want to tuck your left elbow kind of into your body so it stabilizes that part of your
bring
arm.
It into the center of your gut almost.
Right, right. And that will improve things. And just as a really quick experiment, if you've got, you know, one of those 70 to 300 millimeter lenses or, you know, just something with a long focal length, try it both ways. You know, hold your camera with both hands, you know, with that thing zoomed all the way out, and look through the viewfinder and notice how it's kind of shaking around and not too clear. And then try putting your hand underneath the lens, cradling it. Ideally out there a little ways on the lens, not right back at the body, and then tuck your elbow into your stomach and look through the viewfinder, and you'll just see that it's a lot more stable, and that's going to translate directly to sharper images.
Absolutely. You want to make yourself into a tripod.
Yeah. And whether or not you have VR or not in your lens, it's going to help you.
Yep. And there's lots more other kinds of techniques, but we thought we would keep it simple with that because a lot of you guys are out there snapping away on vacation and you want to come back with good images. This is one way you can do that.
Mm-hmm. And experiment a little bit too. If you have a digital camera, heck, do a bunch of test shots and just see what positions and holds work the best for you. It'll be easy to spot them.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And sometimes it's good to shoot off several shots. Because you'll find that even using good technique, some will be a little bit better than another. So,
right.
Yeah.
I always came from the school of take two or three shots.
Yep.
One will be good, right?
Yep.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of another episode. And before we go, we wanted to remind everyone that we're going to be teaching at the second of the two advanced workflow. The advanced digital workflow workshops, and this next one is going to be in June in Dallas, Texas. It starts on June 12th and runs through the 15th. We will be there on the 14th and 15th, teaching the segment on what we talked about last time: Photoshop, RAW workflow, Capture NX, tips and tricks, that kind of stuff.
Black and white,
right? So again, a great opportunity for those Nikonians to come out, not only just to meet us, but Mike Hagen, the primary instructor. He's a really good instructor, and if you ever wanted to make a lot of 13 by 19 size prints, it's
good
worth the price of admission to do that. Yeah, exactly. So we're going to do that.
And you can register for that workshop off the homepage on Nikonians.org. Just look toward the top middle for an item that says workshops.
And I'll put a link to it on the show notes page.
Good idea.
And you can find our show notes at blog.nikonians.org.
And as always, don't forget to vote for us and put in comments on Podcast Alley. We're under Nikonians Talk Radio, not just Nikonians, but Nikonians Talk Radio. And I think there will be a link to that in there too.
Yep. Okay. Well, that wraps it up. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks.
Bye-bye.